Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 31st vote by the House Republicans to repeal what they call Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which has been both passed into law and upheld by the Supreme Court. Ethan Rome, the Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, joins us to discuss why Republicans feel this is a winning strategy and why the Obama administration has allowed the Affordable Care Act to be defined so negatively while not adequately explaining its benefits. Then Elise Hoag joins us, a columnist with The Nation and the former director of political advocacy for MoveOn.org. She has an article at The Nation, Money in, People Out, the Twin Pillars of the GOP's 2012 Strategy. We will discuss both sides of the Republican 2012 strategy for victory in November, prevent as many Democrats as they can from voting, while raising record amounts of money from undisclosed donors to carpet bomb the airwaves and numb the electorate into submission. Then finally, following a groundbreaking article in Vanity Fair by Nicholas Shaxson, Where the Money Lives, we will look into how much money Mitt Romney has been hiding offshore in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and in Swiss banks. Scott Klinger, the Tax Policy Director of Business for a Shared Prosperity, one of the authors of the report Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging, joins us. Joining us now is Ethan Rome, who's an executive director of Healthcare for America Now, a national coalition of more than 1,000 groups in 50 states representing 30 million people. Ethan Rome has been a grassroots and labor activist and organizer for more than 25 years and also worked as chief policy and political advisor to the Connecticut Speaker of the House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ethan Rome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ethan, why is it then that the Republicans have decided in the House to have the 31st vote to repeal Obamacare, knowing that it is largely meaningless? They must feel that this is working for them.
Well, I mean, I think what they've set out to be a do-nothing Congress, and the Republicans in the House are outstanding at that. They are doing nothing, and so meaningless is what they do. You know, it's ironic. You said that this is the 31st vote, and we've been saying the same thing. But today, Speaker Boehner wanted to make sure that we all knew that this was actually the 33rd time that they've had a pointless, meaningless vote to repeal Obamacare. So it's really a stunning thing. I don't know why they think it's a winning strategy to do nothing and then have the one nothing thing that they do over and over and over and over again be to take health care away from ordinary Americans who need it. Doesn't seem like a winning strategy to me.
Well, they must have some polling. I mean, I understand the nature of this Congress. I interviewed the two Washington insiders recently, Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann, who have written the bestseller, It's Worse Than It Looks, which is an indictment of the Congress. And they've suggested that the idea, the Tea Party kind of radicals have moved the Republicans so far to the right that they are essentially dysfunctional. They'd rather grandstand than reach across the aisle and make a deal and do the American people's business. That's pretty clear. But on the other hand, they must be appealing to a constituency with this kind of ridiculous theater. And that's what I wanted to get at. I mean, I understand that in the polling and correct me because I know you're following it, still it's about 50-50 in terms of what the American people think about the Affordable Care Act, isn't it?
Yes, it's still about 50-50. Although a very strong majority of Americans think it's time to move on. I mean, most people in the United States at this point think if a law has been in effect for 2 years and the Supreme Court took it up and upheld it and Congress has been yakking about it, let's move on. Let's move on, particularly since there's already 100 million Americans who are benefiting from this law. And that's the part that the Republicans seem to forget. I'm not sure how they forget that, but, you know, there's extraordinary benefits and consumer protections that people are benefiting from. And so, you know, we're talking about billions of dollars in prescription drug savings for senior citizens, 3 million adult children who are able to stay on their parents' plans. Free preventive care for folks. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And the Republicans know it because they run into constituents all day long who tell them how much they like the components of Obamacare.
But on the other hand, they're blanketing the airwaves, at least Republican surrogates are, suggesting that it's a tax and that Obama lied about it, saying that he wouldn't tax the middle class and working Americans, and that it's a, you know, we've heard all the arguments, the assault on your liberties, all of this stuff.
It's horrible.
But the thing that I find extraordinary, what you just told us about the benefits of this, how many Americans know about this? I mean, first of all, the Affordable Care Act was so backloaded that much of the really important benefits come in late in 2014. So who's selling, who's doing the opposite sale? We know about, if you watch television, you know about the millions that are being spent to trash so-called Obamacare. But where is the countervailing arguments? I haven't seen too many of them, at least not at the extent to which I've seen the opposition to the Affordable Care Act.
Well, certainly, I mean, the opponents have outspent the supporters on the airwaves 3-1, and that's what they do. They take the money of the big corporations, the insurance companies, billionaires like the Koch brothers, and blanket the airwaves and spread lies about the law. Now, that said, though, there's lots of organizations and different efforts all across the country that have been promoting this law. And the best way that people learn about this law is when they benefit from it. And so this summer, for example, 13 million people across this country are going to receive $1 billion in consumer rebates because their insurance companies spend too little on health care and too much on profits and bloated CEO salaries. That's only happening because of this law. And in the last 2 years, for example, 5.3 million seniors in the so-called Medicare donut hole have saved $3.7 billion in their prescription drugs. And so those folks know it, and they talk to one another. And so, you know, that part of this will take a little bit of time, but people are out educating all the time. But I will say this, the other side's working hard, and they got all the money. The one thing, though, that I always say to folks is what's shocking to me is if this law is so bad, as the Republicans say it is, if this is really the law that's going to end civilization in our country as we know it, and if they have outspent us 3-1 on the airwaves using corporate donations and hidden secret money from the insurance companies, why can't they get more than half the people to have a negative point of view about it? Because the reality is every day the support grows, and more people want to keep the law the way it is and want to see it repealed. People are ready to move on, and the Republicans ought to do the same, because what we really need to be doing right now is creating jobs and rebuilding this economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Ethan Rome, who's Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, a national coalition of more than 1,000 groups in 50 states representing 30 million people. But I suspect, though, Ethan, that there is a core support for this on the Republican side that has a lot to do with the perception or misperception that in order for the Affordable Care Act to get passed, the whole point of it, in many ways, a lot of people think, was to insure the uninsured, and that therefore their health care is going to be diminished in order to give the previously uninsured, about 30 million people, some form of insurance. In other words, they're going to be paying for so-called freeloaders. My understanding is that that's a very, very small part of the overall ACA. I also understand, having spent some time with Paul Starr, who's one of the country's leading experts on healthcare from Princeton, that only 8% of people are affected by the so-called mandate that was the centerpiece for months and months of wrangling in the Supreme Court and in the media. So
yeah,
that was.
I have tremendous respect for Paul Starr, but I think he is exaggerating that number by at least seven times.
You mean 8%? You mean there's
1%.
It's
1%.
Well, you explain that then.
In Massachusetts right now, less than 1% of the people are impacted by the so-called mandate. That's the amazing thing about this law. The amazing thing about this law is that it expands coverage to 30 million people who don't have it right now. And it improves insurance coverage for every single one of us who has it, which is the vast majority of Americans. But all of us are sick and tired of being abused by our insurance companies, being denied care, and all that kind of stuff. And this law goes right at that. This law eliminates the worst insurance company abuses, and it expands care, and it also improves the quality of care. Now, when you talk about the Republicans and their strategy, your next guest is going to talk about their broader strategy, and that is to have money dominate our politics and to stop people from voting and to get people out of our politics. And that's what their attack on Obamacare is part of that, because it's part of their attack on government as we know it. It's part of their attack. That's why they want to eliminate Medicare and Medicaid. They want to break down every single service that helps ordinary Americans and that helps the middle class and that helps create the American dream.
But Ethan Rome, I believe that the reason that the argument that Obamacare, as they call it, is going to hurt you and your health care that you're paying for is going to be diminished in order to get a bunch of freeloaders aboard. That, I believe, that appeal to selfishness and ignorance is working. And everything you've told me, I understand, is true. But I'm not. But how do you get to those people who are buying the Republican argument?
Well, I think, to be perfectly honest, I think the people who are buying that argument are the people who believed it before they heard it. And that's where when you talked about your guest who wrote the book about how Washington is broken and it's broken because of the Republicans, they're right. And right now you have a Republican Party that is held hostage by these like whack job Tea Party folk. And so, for example, and it's a self-hating party, so they're going to nominate Mitt Romney, right? Who, by the standards of health care, according to their own standards, is the absolute worst Republican in the United States, bar none, to represent them. Because if you want to know about Obamacare, ask Mitt Romney. And so, because what's great about this law is that it does not impact anybody who has insurance negatively. It only helps people. And when we talk about who's going to get the coverage who doesn't have it now, we're talking about middle-class folk. The average household buying insurance through these new exchanges is going to get a tax credit of $5,200. And that's working class folks who don't have insurance because their job doesn't provide it. It's people who will have health insurance no matter what, even if they lose their job or have a change of income or a change of circumstance. And that's what we're talking about. All of us are scared about losing our health insurance. We all know people who've stayed in jobs longer than they want, or are held hostage to a job because they can't afford to lose their insurance. And so what this law is about is bringing peace of mind to every single one of us who worries about health care. And the Republicans, God bless them for wanting to keep repealing this thing over and over again, but they're trying to appeal to a very small base in their party. But the real base that they're trying to appeal to are the corporate donors, the big corporations who own them. And that's the thing that we always have to remember. It's big oil, it's the big insurance companies, it's billionaires like the Koch brothers, it's the people who want to systematically undermine the economic security of the middle class, take away programs like Medicaid and Medicare. That's who the Republicans work for. And that's what today's vote was about. Today was about repealing Obamacare for no other reason than trying to attack the middle class and the programs that support it.
But Ethan Rome, the exchanges that you said would benefit people greatly, and obviously they will once they get into play, they will reduce people's insurance bills enormously and give them guarantees, and that they won't be arbitrarily struck off for pre-existing conditions and all of those things that which I think you, as you rightly point out, most people are really disgusted with their insurance companies and the behavior with which they've treated them. And so finally, we actually have a policeman on the beat here that's going to make sure that they do right by their customers. But when's this going to happen? I mean, the states are all fighting it. I haven't seen one insurance exchange yet. How long will it take for these things to get up and running?
I mean, the exchanges are going to be up and running by the end of 2013. Implementation is remarkably moving forward. You know, the Obama administration has really done a terrific job, and Secretary Sebelius at HHS has done a great job, because while the Republicans have taken this to court and while they've been trashing this in the newspaper day in and day out, the administration's been moving forward. The vast majority of states have been moving forward. There's some important exceptions. You know, Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, right, who's opposed to civilization, labor, voting rights, you know, anything, right, of any value. He's trying to hold this thing up, too. So, too, is Rick Scott in Florida, Governor Rick Scott. But for the most part, this thing is moving forward. But again, the most important thing is that right now, 100 million Americans already benefiting, because huge parts of the law have already gone into effect. And so if you already have insurance and you're listening to this program, you no longer have a lifetime limit on your coverage, first time ever. And in a year's time, there won't be an annual limit on your coverage. In a year's time, they won't be able to deny you care based on a pre-existing condition. Right now, it's illegal for insurance companies to deny children care based on a pre-existing condition or to overcharge. And so those are the kinds of new benefits and protections that are happening right now. And that's what's extraordinary about the law, is that from the day it passed, it was already making a difference in people's lives.
So the stuff that you're telling us, which I'm sure is music to the ears of our audience, who's going to tell the American people while they're getting bombarded by these negative messages? I mean, you say that your side of the argument of being outspent 3-1, the one side of the, you know, the one third of the media that's trying to defeat the attacks on the Affordable Care Act. Who are they, and can they get the same kind of clear message that you just told our audience? Because, I mean, clearly, once people know what's in this bill for them, the opposition will melt.
Well, I mean, I think, as I said, I think some of it really does. I mean, you're asking a very good question, but some of it takes time. I mean, the day of the Supreme Court's ruling, the president gave a live speech, and it was an extraordinary articulation, concrete benefit after concrete benefit of what this law does. And as I said, people all over the country are systematically learning what the law does through their own experience. I mean, so many of us know parents, for example, whose adult children are now able to stay on their health plan and have insurance instead of being out in the job market for the first time without coverage. And so, you know, that's happening over time. And we're going to have a huge debate about this law between now and Election Day. And it's a debate that we're going to win. It's going to be a debate that we win. And no matter how much the other side spends, and again, I think Elise Hogue, your next guest, is going to talk about this in part, but, you know, the billionaire Koch brothers, Karl Rove, Big Oil, the big insurance companies, Wall Street, they've all said they're going to spend $100 billion to bring down Barack Obama and this law and the other good things that have occurred in the last several years. And we all just have to fight that. And part of fighting that is by spreading the word about this law. And you can come to our website, healthcareforamericanow.org, and we'll connect you with some action in your area.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Ethan Rome.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ethan Rome, who's Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, a national coalition of more than 1,000 groups in 50 states representing 30 million people. Ethan Rome has been a grassroots and labor activist and organizer for more than 25 years and also worked as chief policy and political advisor to the Connecticut Speaker of the House of Representatives. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Elise Hoge about the 1-2 Republican punch.
I don't need no doctor, 'cause I know what's in me. I don't need no doctor, no, no, 'cause I know what's in me. Yeah. Been too long away from a man.
You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elise Hoge, who's a columnist with The Nation and was previously the director of political advocacy and communications for MoveOn.org, where she previously served as its campaign director. Before joining MoveOn, she spent 7 years as program director for the Rainforest Action Network. She has an article at The Nation, Money in, People Out, The Twin Pillars of the GOP's 2012 Plan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elise Hoge.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And it is pretty clear that the Republicans have a plan, and it has many facets, and it's highly organized. It involves the Republican leadership. It involves ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. It involves a kind of cadre of billionaires. But it obviously goes back to before 2012. Recently in the Weekly Standard, Fred Barnes, a Republican propagandist, if you will, was actually celebrating how much the super PACs had helped them in 2010. And in 2012, it was just going to happen exponentially. So we've seen what's happened in Wisconsin. Can't they just simply carpet bomb the country and win this one?
You know, that's what I find so fascinating, Ian, is that if you actually step back and the whole picture comes into focus, it's clear that the GOP does not believe they can win on ads and money alone. And neither do I, quite honestly. I mean, as, you know, a progressive, I believe that our biggest advantage is that we have plenty of people. And you know, when the people have a voice in the system and can exercise their constitutional right to vote, more often than not, they are going to side in their best interest, which is with the more progressive of the candidates. Well, the GOP understands this, obviously. And so what's been fascinating to me, as I wrote in the piece, is, you know, while it's the money they flaunt, it's actually the people that they fear. Hence their sort of lockstep, hand-in-hand strategy of voter suppression, keeping the people out, and carpet-bombing the country with ads, bringing the money in.
But in the Wisconsin recall election, apparently 30% of union members voted against the repeal of or the recall of Governor Scott Walker, and 50% of union households voted against the recall of Governor Scott Walker. So that tells me that the progressive side is seriously lacking in educating their voters.
Yeah, I absolutely don't want to gloss over the fact that there's an issue with our ability to actually mobilize people. And it's not just mobilizing, it's inspiring, right? Like, people absolutely have to feel as though their vote's going to count in the end for them to get up, take off work. You know, we're one of the countries that doesn't actually give you time off work to go vote and actually go cast your ballot. I would caution your listeners about extrapolating too much from Wisconsin to the federal election. The exit polls also showed that despite the fact that the recall effort failed, Obama was still leading in Wisconsin. So I think this is a bit of apples and oranges. In fact, you know, I wrote another column. What I really think was going down in Wisconsin is that folks were just election fatigued, right? Between 2010 and 2012 and what went down, there was an election every month, every couple months, every 2 weeks at certain periods of time, and there was a fatigue that set in, and there was a general feeling that the recall itself was overreach, that we should only use recalls in the case of illegal activity and not legislative malfeasance. So I would just caution your listeners to say, oh, well, that happened in Wisconsin, so it can happen nationally. I actually think we're facing something very different this November.
And I think you have to add to that that the candidates that the Democrats chose to run against Governor Scott Walker was less than inspiring, and he was recycled from his previous loss in the last round. So that might have been a factor as well. So apparently in these swing states, Obama's latest television ad campaign is apparently having some effect, that pinning Romney to the outsourcing and making the comparison that Obama's the president who insources, Romney's the guy that outsources, and also these lingering questions about Romney's wealth and how much of it's hidden, and the fact that he hangs out with billionaires who are basically, in large part, funding his campaign. Is that your understanding, that this early framing of Romney by Obama is being effective?
Yeah, I've read the same polls you have, but I'll tell you what, it doesn't surprise me a bit, Ian. You know, one of the things that people are really desperate for right now is a candidate that they can trust to A, understand what they're going through, and B, want to fix it. And I think people already had questions about Romney's ability to understand what they're going through. He shows how out of touch he is every time he walks up to a guy at the fairgrounds wearing a poncho and says, hey, really spent the big bucks on your rain jacket there, or refers to NASCAR owners as his friends rather than understanding the sport itself or the drivers. He's out of touch, right? So then the question becomes, even if he's out of touch, do we think he wants to help us? Right? Do we think he actually is going to empathize more than the current president and shift our situation? And the Bain stuff is just incredibly damning on that front. He showed no understanding and no remorse for the number of people he axed from their jobs, shipped them overseas, shut down factories. It was all in the name of profit. And I think it's a big blow.
Well, Elise Hogue, you mentioned a little while ago that the U.S. is among the few countries that don't give people a day off and that they vote on Tuesdays, whereas most other democracies vote on the weekend. I think it's actually pretty much alone in its history of voter restrictions. And, as much as we celebrate the founding fathers, myself, having lived in other European countries and Australia, I have some sense of comparison, and it's pretty extraordinary the number of hoops you have to go through to vote and how arbitrary they are and how they on a different state-by-state basis they can be gamed. So we know that the Brennan Center did a study about a year or 6 months ago that suggested that up to 5 million people, eligible Democratic voters, are going to be purged by these Republican state government initiatives to, supposedly in the name of voter fraud, to demand voter IDs and other restrictions. That seems to be working, but on the other hand, there are a lot of lawsuits out there, and the Attorney General may not be putting Wall Street banksters in jail, but he seems to at least be on the case in terms of trying to strike down these voter restrictions, which he's recently referred to as a poll tax. Do you have a sense that the Attorney General is going to prevail?
I think it's a question of timeline, isn't it, Ian? I think that the Attorney General seems actually quite genuine in his effort to preserve the vote for every American, but he's also exercising his force within the constraint of the law, and there's a process that has to be gone through to adhere to the way our legal system works, and eventually it ends up with the judiciary, which, someone once said to me, and it stuck with me, the left sees the courts as a pathway to justice, the right sees it as a pathway to power. And so when we started to see a judiciary that's motivated by politics more than by the law, you have to be concerned about that as a long-term strategy. But I support what the what Attorney General Holder is doing in terms of holding their feet to the fire to make sure every American can vote. I think, you know, the question is really whether we as Americans are going to come together and recognize that, again, these are two parts of the same plan, and that this is the length that the Republican Party will go to in order to win an election. It will rob American citizens of the one right that allows us to believe we live in a representative democracy. And you know what? I think that they think the impacts to the integrity and the trust in our form of government, be damned. They're going to win the election. And for any American that actually cares more about our country and about what makes it great and what keeps people loving it and keeps people trusting it more than they care about any individual candidate or any individual party, this is an outrage, and we should be standing up.
Well, do you think that appealing to people's sense of patriotism and sense of fairness, and it seems obvious that in the real world you should be able to shame, every Democratic candidate ought to be able to shame his Republican opponent into recognizing how disgraceful it is to not even want to have a level playing field and to resort to those kinds of anti-democratic and historically disgraceful ploys of restricting and preventing people from voting. But I just wonder how much the electorate is so damn jaded with all the money that's pouring in, all of the hit jobs on both sides. Are we at a point where we have lost our sense of outrage?
Well, I think that we really have to guard against apathy. I think it's real, and I think we have to not only talk about, you know, point in the direction of all the different fires burning, but offer an alternative that actually makes people want to engage and believe that their engagement has impact. But I actually think that the first thing you said is really critical for your listeners to understand. Not only is this part of one plan, but their part of their strategy is to divide and conquer. If they keep one constituency of Democrats focused over here and the other over here, look, the Achilles heel of their entire strategy is the voter suppression stuff, because people understand that is the heartbeat of our democracy. That's why you had so many companies pulling out of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They knew that they could not, either by their conscience or because of their brand integrity, they could not stand to be part of a body that actually took away that heartbeat of democracy. So this is the Achilles heel of their whole strategy. The question is whether we will allow ourselves to be divided and distracted in all of these different directions, or whether we can recognize the entire plan for what it is and be strategic in how we actually stand up for our democracy and stop their takeover.
Well, Elise Hogue, it would seem, though, that equally and opposite in terms of this 1-2 punch, the twin pillars of GOP's 2012 plan that you've written about in The Nation, Elise Hogue, money in and people out. We've just talked about people out, the people out strategy, the money in strategy. One of the things that I find extraordinary about it, and again, it seems that so far they're getting away with it, is these so-called social welfare vehicles that the IRS have set up that are now being used, and under Wisconsin Right to Life ruling, it's open sesame on the ability of not just billionaires, but corporations to hide their political donations. And we know from the last cycle in, I believe it was in Wisconsin, where the homophobic candidate was supported by money from Target, the big retailer.
Yeah, that was in Minnesota.
Minnesota, yep. Right. That there was a tremendous backlash to that. And we know that basic corporations are very careful about giving their money because they don't want to offend half of their customers if half of their customers are Democrats and the other half are Republicans, which is pretty much the way it is in this country. So what about that? I mean, the money in part is so opaque that that's what concerns me, and I wonder if there's any way to flush that one out before November.
Well, I mean, there are a couple of ways, right? There's a court that's ruled that disclosure is absolutely necessary to allow voters to know who they're voting for. There's another vote on disclose, the actual legislative bill coming up at the end of the month in the Senate, and folks should absolutely, this matters. This is a time where the senators, because their own own self-preservation is at stake, because every Democratic senator can see how he or she might go down if things continue on this track. This is a place where they're willing to step out, but they need to hear from their constituents. So there are a couple of ways to do that, but you're absolutely right that that there is more corporate money flowing into the system than we originally understood. It's just being shielded by these C4s. You know, I think the bottom line is none of this is rocket science to fix, right? We know we need transparency so voters absolutely understand who it is that's backing the candidate so that they know where the candidate's loyalty will lay. We know that we actually need a system that says corporations are not people and unlimited spending actually is unfair to every voter. We know that we actually need to stop voter suppression, and we actually know that we need what I call citizen-led elections, which is the matching system that New York City has, that Arizona has, that says only when you have enough support in your own district, then you can get matching grants from the government. And we know that that increases the diversity of candidates. So these are things that we know how to do. We only need the political will to do them. And that's what's going to get people over the apathy. This is not a question of not having a solution. The solutions are there. When enough people stand up and say, I've had it, it's not because it's about the Democrats winning or the Republicans winning, because at the end of the day, it's absolutely not. It's about representative democracy that made America what it is, persevering. That's when we're going to have the political will to implement the solutions that already exist to these problems.
So, Elise Hogue, just to finish up on the money in part of the 1-2 punch, money in, people out, the twin pillars of the GOP's 2012 plan, the article that you've written in The Nation. I did an interview recently with a business investigative reporter with the Boston Globe who investigated the first big deal at Bain that Romney made his biggest killing on. And it was financed by Michael Milken, who himself was under SEC investigation at the time. But, and you know, I have very limited resources compared to the rest of the media, but just with a cursory inquiry and with the help of a friend of mine, Jonathan Taplin, who's a sharp guy in terms of knows the business world, we find out that all of the big super PAC donors, Adelson, David Koch, and Simmons, were all financed by Michael Milken. And Koch himself is, of course, on the chairman of the board of Milken's foundation. So there's a kind of weird DNA to this story. And I wish other people, I know you've pointed out here what the self-interest of Adelson is in getting rid of Obama and having Romney elected. And he's prepared to spend up $100 million. And that is because most of his money comes from offshore, from gambling casinos in Macau and Singapore. He wants that loophole open where the U.S. Treasury can't tax all these offshore profits. But what do you think about some good forensic financial investigation here? Don't you think it's needed?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think we're going to see it, right? This Department of Justice has been more aggressive in pursuing some of these cases of American companies operating outside of the law overseas to make maximum profits, to keep them overseas so that they're eroding our tax base. And, you know, I think that the SEC is going to get involved as well. But I think the point that you are underscoring is the self-interest involved. You know, there's been a lot of, like, a sort of wringing of hands about whether the Democratic super PACs can raise as much money, and I address this in my piece. You know, the answer is no. They absolutely can't, because they're not offering the same return on their investment. Adelson is paying $10 million, which, you know, when you are worth what he's worth, which is $25 billion, that's absolutely nothing, because what's at stake there is a whole hell of a lot of money, but also his freedom. He's being investigated, and you're not going to find Democratic candidates that are, you know, horse trading like that. Some will. This is not a party of purity, right? The whole system is corrupt. But we see that more on the right than we do on the left, and therefore the super PACs are raising more money because there's more transactions to be done in the business world. And you know what? My biggest fear, again, goes back to democracy, because when the rules get changed, then people change to fit the rules. And if both parties actually start behaving in that transactional way in order to compete in the elections, then 90% of Americans get left out of the process.
Well, just in closing, then, Elise Hoag, I mean, it seems obvious to me that Adelson's already had a profound effect on this election. You know from the New York Times story that that Romney and Netanyahu are extremely close and they go back a long way. And there's no question that Sheldon Adelson has devoted his fortune or is prepared to devote his fortune to Netanyahu. He's funded a television network like Fox in Israel. He's also funds a free newspaper that's given out that's devoted to Netanyahu. And it's difficult not to see why he backed Newt Gingrich in the primaries, because Newt Gingrich split the anti-Romney vote. So arguably, I mean, this is my theory, that Adelson has been supporting Romney all along. I guess the question about money on the right versus money on the left is that there's so many of the guys on the right seem to have a direct financial interest in their candidate and what they're going to get out of him when he becomes president. Conversely, on the left, you've got, the guy they compare the money bags on the right to is George Soros, but I don't think he has a lot of stuff before the government. I mean, so the people on the left have to give out of altruism. The people on the right give out of self-interest.
I don't know that it's altruism. I mean, I think that's a misnomer. I think that even high donors who give to Democrats actually believe that everybody does better when we all do better, that their businesses do better when consumers have money in their pockets to go shopping, that their cities and their communities are better when the schools are funded and we're turning out an educated workforce. So I think altruism is overrated. It's a nice idea. I think it's really just that the people on the left are not looking for a direct one-for-one trade often, where in many cases, not all, but in many cases at the big donor level on the right, you know, like Adelson with his legal troubles, you can find something that they're really, really seeking.
Well, Elise Hoag, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Again, I've been speaking with Elise Hoag, who's a columnist with The Nation and was previously the director of political advocacy and communications for MoveOn.org, where she previously served as its campaign director. Before joining MoveOn.org, she spent 7 years as program director for the Rainforest Action Network, and she has an article at The Nation, Money In, People Out, the Twin Pillars of the GOP's 2012 Plan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how much money Mitt Romney's hiding offshore.
So excuse me, Mr. Butter, I'm a Mr. Two, and you're giving Mr. Bad Name, Mr. Like You. So I'm taking the Mr. from out in front of your name, 'cause it's Mr. Like You that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr. Like.
You need it, that's for sure. You receive, but always want more. But the day is coming, the day is near. The day is coming, you know what I mean.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management, and is one of the authors of the report Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thank you, Ian.
And Scott, I'm sure you saw the Vanity Fair article by Nicholas Shaxson, who a British investigative reporter who wrote the sort of definitive book on offshore tax havens, Treasure Islands. It's called Where the Money Lives.
That's right. It's a shocking report. It looks at Mitt Romney's offshore holdings of his quarter of $1 billion of assets, $250 million of assets. By his accounting, Nick Shaxson says that At least 30 million of that is offshore in the Cayman Islands, tax haven country.
Because what, there are 138 different accounts under Bain Capital there?
That's right. Bain has money of its investment funds registered in the Cayman Islands, and Mitt Romney has interest in at least 12 of those funds, which is how he calculated the value of the $30 million.
And the article goes on to suggest that Romney's wealth is even greater than previous estimates?
Yes, it keeps going up. He keeps getting additional distributions from Bain each year, even though he hasn't worked there since 1999. And we don't really understand a lot about this. He hasn't, Mr. Romney hasn't disclosed a lot of the details of his post-employment arrangement with Bain, but he keeps getting money. Last year he got $2 million in new funds from Bain.
Well, we know that he, when Romney ran for the United States Senate in 1994, he wouldn't release any tax returns. And then when he ran for governor of Massachusetts when he went for the Massachusetts governor and the Republican presidential nomination in 2008, he again refused. And it was only after being goaded by Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry in this election primary that he released his 2010 tax return and an estimate for 2011. But that, of course, many people have pointed this out, is in stark contrast to what his father did when he ran back in the 60s, where he was extremely open and forthcoming. So what is it about Mitt Romney? Is it just that he doesn't believe it's the anybody else's business, or does he have something to hide?
Well, I can't really speak to what's in his heart and what his motivations are, but it's clear that he's worried. He said publicly that before he agreed to disclose his tax forms, that he was worried the Democrats would use it to use it against him. And in fact, that's exactly what's happened, because there's a lot of unanswered questions in his tax returns. It's interesting, when he ran in Massachusetts, there are state ethics disclosures, but they're much less rigorous than one's tax form. So earlier this year, when he disclosed his tax form, a lot of new information came out that wasn't known from his prior state ethics disclosure forms. And one of the things that his tax return bore out was that he had 50 pages of returns relating to his foreign investments, many of them in tax haven countries like the Cayman Islands and Luxembourg and Bermuda.
And there was a $3 million Swiss bank account which appeared in his 2010 return. That came out of nowhere.
That's right, yep.
So the point being that there could be a whole lot more of these, right? Like his father, I think his father released about 7 years, and he wanted the public to know that he'd worked hard, and lightning hadn't struck, you know.
That's right. I think there was some mention in the article that some things had changed between 2010 and 2011, where they were trying to get rid of some of the investments, I think, in Switzerland and other things, so they didn't have to show up. It's worth saying that Mitt Romney is not an isolated example, that this is the way that many wealthy Americans deal with their money. The IRS has had a amnesty program for people who were evading taxes in Switzerland, and 33,000 Americans came forward over the last 3 or 4 years and said and confessed their tax evasion, paid penalties, but avoided jail time and other criminal prosecutions. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of people that are still housing their money in secret locations to evade taxes. No one's arguing, I don't think, that Mitt Romney's evading taxes illegally or hiding assets that are undisclosed at this point. But, the whole thing ends up the way people manage their money so that they can avoid paying taxes in this country.
Well, but the taxes that Mitt and Ann Romney paid, based upon the 2010 and the partial 2011 returns, that the only things that he's ever released, he paid $6.2 million on federal taxes of $42.5 million, which is an average rate just shy of 15%. And of course, that is, you know, the average working stiff pays 35% on ordinary income, such as salaries and wages. And of course, the magic that that Mitt Romney has, which all of the wealthy have, is this tax loophole called carried interest.
That's right. So the money that he earned while at Bain was deemed to be a capital gain, not a salary. So it was taxed at the 15% capital gain rate, and as you said, not the higher rate that the rest of us pay. The interesting thing is that he continues to do that even though he hasn't worked at Bain since 1999, and there's some question about whether how legitimate that is to continue calling something carried interest when he's not putting sweat equity into it. It's just residual money that's coming out of work that he did 13 years ago.
And there are also mysteries about his IRA account from Bain Capital. I've never heard of anybody having up to $102 million in an IRA.
Well, he's not alone on that either. I'm working on a piece right now looking at corporate CEOs, and there are other people in that sphere. But yes, it does raise a lot of questions in terms of how he could get that much, since IRA contributions are capped. And one of the points that Nick Jackson's excellent piece, Where the Money Lives, points out is that when he was at Bain, when they did deals, they had two classes of stock, one of which was very high risk but also high return. That went to people like Mr. Romney and other partners of Bain Capital, and then a more moderate risk investment that went to their clients. On the pieces that Mitt Romney took, you either struck out and lost your money, or you made fabulous returns. I think in one case they were talking about an investment that returned 600-fold. That's not 600%, it's 600 times the original value of the investment. So if they put a dollar in, they get 600 back. Those kinds of returns are outlandish. And that's the sort of thing that he was doing within his IRA, I suspect.
Was that the deal that he did with Goldman Sachs?
I don't know the details of it. It wasn't the partners weren't in the article that I recall.
Right. Well, he did a deal with Goldman where Bain put down $85 million, and they made out like bandits with a $280 million profit. It was to do with Dade, which was a medical device company, which they absolutely devastated, and they treated the people with these the workers with these brutal cost cutting measures and leveraged
their pension funds, right?
Yeah, yep. And they leveraged their pension funds. Yep. They squeezed from the pension pot, then used that to create new rosier financial projections. I'm just reading from the Shaxton article. They squeezed from the pension pot, then used that to create new rosier financial projections to borrow several times that amount, and then they paid themselves big special dividends from the borrowed funds, many times the size of the pension savings. And that's how, from putting down $85 million, they ended up with a $280 million profit and left the medical company, Dade, with more than $870 million in debts. I mean, it's an amazing piece of...
And then they went bankrupt and walked away, right?
Right. Now, but the IRA stuff, you know, that's mysterious because I thought they were capped. You said they were capped. Aren't they capped at $30,000 a year? So how could you have $102 million?
Yeah. I mean, unless you got these extraordinary returns.
I see. Well, Scott Klinger again, Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and one of the authors of the report, Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. And you pointed out, in fairness, that Mitt Romney's not a tax dodger. He's just that, as he said, I haven't paid a dollar more than I have to. Probably a lot of people in America think that's okay, right? But
Well, the rules are rigged, and I think there's a pretty wide sentiment across the political spectrum that there's two sets of rules in this country, one for rich people and one for everyone else. And I think that's what people want closed. They want an end to that. They want fairness in the tax system. And these kinds of stories, like Nick Jackson wrote, demonstrate how the system's rigged and why it's unfair.
So What struck you, though, about these revelations? I mean, some of the people that he's made deals with are pretty... I mean, there's this fellow, Paul Singer, who is a lot of very unsavory things have been written about him, particularly his investments in the Congo in you know, blood diamonds, blood minerals. The place is an absolute bloodbath. I think 5 million people have died in the last decade there. And yet he is apparently plundering the place.
He also does this vulture investing, in which they buy up the debt of poor nations at pennies on the dollar and then sue them in international court demanding that they pay 100 cents on the dollar, you know, just exacerbating, you know, some of the poorest countries on earth, the problems they face.
So that's the fund that... Romney invested at least $1 million in Elliott Associates,
LP, right.
The distressed asset vulture capitalist funds, and this guy, Paul Singer, has given Romney's super PAC Restore Our Future $1 million, right?
Right.
So, you know, this is an amazing this is a different America from the one that you and I live in, particularly when you have these devices, like in the Cayman Islands, I just learned about, never heard about them, these offshore blocker corporations, that not only do you hide money through these shingles, these fronts, these, you know, paper conveniences that they have there, because there's no money in the Cayman Islands, it's all paper, right? But then they have this other device called a blocker corporation. Tell us about them.
Well, a blocker corporation is a corporation where you can... pass your money through and avoid a certain kind of tax that you'd have to pay otherwise on it, and so it's commonly used. But to your point about the Cayman Islands, I recently came across a Treasury Department report that they do every year that lists how much U.S. assets are held in various countries around the world, and the number one country continues to be the United Kingdom, UK, Britain. Which has $839 billion of U.S. corporate assets. Right behind it, fast on its heels, the Cayman Islands, $736 billion. Luxembourg, another tax haven, is $670. And then Canada is a distant fourth at $509 billion. The really surprising thing is you'd think Germany, you know, might have a lot of investments here. They have a lot of plants and a lot of corporate investments. They only have $166 billion, less than a fourth that the Cayman Islands has. So this is a very pervasive problem. Half of the trade in the world passes through tax havens at some point to be sheltered from taxes and or hidden from authorities. There's 70 tax havens. The number's growing all the time. Poor countries see it as a way to bring in a little bit of revenue. It's becoming a greater trend in Africa, which is very worrisome. And the money that leaves poor nations is estimated to be 10 times the amount that comes in aid from other countries. So it's not just about, you know, a questionable way to live. It really has dire effects in this world in terms of poverty, in terms of security. A lot of drug dealers and arms traders and terrorist money is hidden in these places. So there's a lot of reasons people should care about it. And I would just echo what you said at the start, that Nick's book, Treasure Islands, it was the most fascinating book I read last year when it came out. And I would really commend it to your readers, to your listeners.
Well, we've run out of time, I'm afraid, Scott Klinger. But the general question I want to ask is about the growing financialization of our economy and having Mitt Romney as the poster boy for this extraction model where they extract wealth and don't create it. And it seems unsustainable over the long run. And it's extraordinary to think that he's the guy that the 1% are running for president. And he may actually make it if they suppress enough votes and buy enough votes in terms of the media domination. I thank you for joining us, Scott Klinger.
Thank you so much, Ian. Have a good evening.
You too. Again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and the author of the report, Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One time, one time.